Welcome back to part three of our episode, Raising Children with Mental Illness. I'm Hannah Stanley, host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. Joining us now is Lauren Wetzel, a doctoral candidate in Adler's PsyD program. Lauren, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Now, how is the medical community not meeting the needs of families who have children with mental illness?
Well, I think what's important to note is that there are 4 million children suffering from mental illness in the United States. And of that, there are only 20% who are actually identified and receiving mental health services. So when you consider the amount of children who are in the mental health system, and the fact that only 10% of their families are then receiving any information about mental health, you have a lot of families that are out there who don't have any information about what their children are going through.
All right, let's clarify what we're talking about, because when we had the other Lauren in during segment two, we were talking about how 1 in 5 children would be considered having mental illness. What is under that umbrella of that phrase, mental illness?
Sure. So mental illness actually includes a lot of different categories. When you're thinking about behavior, right, you're looking at depression, anxiety, that could be a lot of behavioral problems that teachers might identify in school. And oftentimes what is the problem is that when we don't have information about what mental health is, oftentimes families and other systems that work with the children, including schools, including mental health facilities and hospitals, can tend to label the children as being lazy or as being a problem child. And you don't understand what the purpose is of that behavior for the child. And oftentimes the child then will continue those patterns because they're not getting that adequate support.
And so what it really is just either a reaction or due to the anxiety, the depression, or something that's a little bit more elevated that would still be considered mental illness.
Right.
Okay. So at this point, we've got 1 in 5 who would be in that category of having mental illness. Now, of those, that equals approximately 4 million. Mm-hmm. And of those, there's only how many percent that are actually receiving treatment?
20%.
Okay. So now how can we fix this? Who do we need to have be more responsible, or who do we need to educate better to recognize these other 80%?
I think it's really important that the family be at the forefront of that. If you think about it, they're actually, in terms of families, right, we conceptualize them in different ways, but a family doesn't just include the parents and the children. A family includes siblings. It can include other caregivers. It could include uncles, aunts, grandparents. But the way that our system typically looks at families is the parents and the child. Mm-hmm. And that's how care is addressed oftentimes. Mm-hmm. But 80% of families where there is a child living with mental illness actually do have siblings, too. And so that's approximately 3.4 million siblings of children living with mental illness also who are not receiving that information.
Right, because then the siblings have to adjust their behavior based on how that sibling who has the mental illness reacts or interacts with the family. So this is something that does affect the entire family. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now, and I also mentioned this in the second segment, that my son was exhibiting different behavior. He was always a nervous kid. You know, like even when he was a toddler, he was really antsy and nervous. But when he entered second grade, I realized that things changed a little bit. He was having a lot of I will say anger. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't over the top, but it was different. Mm-hmm. And that's when we started taking him to see a psychologist and start getting some tools to better work through his anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that I, as a parent, recognized. His teacher did not see it. She was shocked because he never exhibited these behaviors at school. So you can have a rule follower kid who's like, okay, this is my behavior and this is how I'm supposed to be and I'm going to be perfect. And then when I get home, it's my safe place and I can do that. A nanny, a parent, a grandparent, a caregiver, a coach can recognize these signs. But we're still in a place where there is a stigma. Mm-hmm. And a coach or a nanny might be uncomfortable in going, you might want to get that kid checked out. Mm-hmm. Because that's that would put possibly a parent into a defensive mode of, my child is not abnormal. This is, it's just who he is. So how can we better educate the parents and that front line that if this is something that comes to the forefront, this is okay?
Well, I think, you know, in schools in particular, we are very focused on behaviors that disrupt other children, mm-hmm. right? So we look at who's the kid who's throwing the chair instead of who's the kid who is more withdrawn. And oftentimes we don't consider that both of these experiences are equally valid and equally important.
Okay.
And so I think there needs to be more recognition of those symptoms that people hold in. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes within the system, where you might find some resistance is that a family can experience a lot of conflict, but one family member might hold that in terms of the symptoms. And so a family may not recognize that that's what's going on, but there might be some resistance to change because if that one family member starts to improve, then that means change for the other family members.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the barriers that we are seeing in 80% is a lot of children and a lot of families whose life could be somewhat improved, or at least that child's life could be improved if they were to get treatment for that undiagnosed mental illness. So what are we seeing as part of the issue in getting a proper diagnosis?
A lot of children's experiences, they are demonstrated differently than adults' experiences with mental illness. So a child who is experiencing depression may display more aggressive behaviors as part of that expression, where an adult may be more tearful. And so it really depends on age. It can depend on the gender of the child, and that has to do a lot with social norms. We raise boys to be more external in the world, and we raise girls to be more comfortable with being tearful at times. And so I think some of that shift needs to happen. Thinking about the family system in particular, I think it's important that we help parents, but also siblings, to understand that the child who is experiencing these symptoms really is not somebody to be afraid of. A lot of times when there is a lack of information, siblings and parents can become fearful of that child. They could also become resentful. This is particularly true if you think about siblings, because parents may be focusing a lot of their energy on the child living with mental illness in order to meet their needs and really leave other siblings to sort of fend for themselves in a lot of ways. And so that child might take on a caretaking role for the sibling. They may also take on a role of really sort of trying to meet the expectations that their parent held for the other sibling. And so there can be a lot of resentment there. They may blame the child for the mental illness, say that you just need to toughen up or you need to stop being so lazy, right? When really that doesn't get at the root of what's causing and maintaining this experience for the child. For parents, they might try to use more harsh discipline in order to manage those behaviors, when really that's going to exacerbate the behavior.
Okay, because it's actually their behavior is a reaction to what's going on to begin with.
Right.
So then if they're punished for it, it's only going to make it worse.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And this leaves other family members prone to experiencing mental health concerns themselves. A lot of
including depression, anxiety.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Either as a response to caregiving or also just as a response of holding that stigma for the family. Families might have a value of privacy and be concerned about talking about the mental illness. They might really cut off ties with that family member who's experiencing mental illness. And they might start to then inadvertently promote some of these stigmatized beliefs in doing so.
Oh, okay. So the things that, all right, now I get it. So when are we seeing economic issues in like, are, is it more common in more urban settings for diagnoses or poorer neighborhoods? Where are we seeing the biggest gap in who's properly being diagnosed?
So one thing I think that is a myth about mental illness is that it occurs within a particular population or a particular area. Mental illness can occur anywhere to anyone. I think it's a matter of resources and how that is approached and how it is recognized. So if you think about a community that is a more disadvantaged community economically, then you're going to have to consider other factors that might prevent them from getting the education that they need.
About mental illness.
About mental illness.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you think about a hospital in particular, oftentimes children will go into a hospital because of some level of risk. And the parents may be experiencing a lot of economic disadvantage. It might be hard for them to get transportation to the hospital to get that information. It may be difficult to reach them by phone or email because maybe they don't have a phone all the time, or they don't have access to email or internet. You may also have some difficulties in approaching them because maybe they work multiple jobs. And so when are they going to come in? And if you get them in to the hospital to give them that information, you have to think about their own level of understanding. Sometimes when there is a gap in education, the caregivers might not understand all of the psychological jargon that you're discussing with them. So you really need to put it in appropriate, understandable terminology. You may also have different developmental levels in the room. If you have children who are siblings, maybe you have an 8-year-old and a 13-year-old, and then you have parents or caregivers, you're going to want to share that information in a way that the 8-year-old is going to be able to understand. Also, you might have some difficulties because stress can make it difficult to concentrate.
Okay.
And so they may not hear all of the information that you're providing and really be able to receive that and understand it in the moment if they're experiencing a lot of stress.
Okay, so I'm actually going to go two different directions. When you said stress, something that was in my mind the whole time was that perhaps the medical professional is writing off some of this anxiety and stuff as stress because they have multiple jobs, because they're food insecure, because of several different reasons. They can go, oh, once that gets taken care of, they'll be fine, when it actually is a mental illness in addition to these other stressors. But also, when you're not necessarily taking in this information because it's stressful to hear, even if you completely understand and you're, you know, it's being communicated properly, it also is something that you don't want your child to have cancer. You don't want your child to have a mental illness, and so it's easier to disregard it and go, he's going to be fine. It's a phase. And also go, no, I don't want this. I didn't choose this. I'm just going to pretend it didn't happen, because it does cause stress to have that diagnosis.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of literature that actually compares the diagnosis of mental illness to loss. And I think that that's true for parents and for siblings and other family members, that if a child is diagnosed with mental illness, maybe later on in their childhood, that you have this certain understanding and relationship with the child prior to this diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that understanding can shift after the diagnosis, and therefore your expectations for your future and your relationship with this child then shift. And that has to be a process that family members gain support around.
Yeah, because you're obviously disappointed for what your hopes and expectations were, but you're not disappointed in the child necessarily.
Right.
I mean, I could see where some people could have that happen. It could slip that way. But that's also very stressful.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now we're at a point that 80% are not being diagnosed. So how can we, and we're understanding a little bit of why, how can we improve it?
So thinking about hospitals, first of all, a lot of times this is a family's first experience with mental health. A child is, you know, committing perhaps suicidal behaviors, or is maybe aggressive in a particular setting, or something is noticed mm-hmm. by the family or other systems. And so they come in and they have a very short stay, but oftentimes what is involved in that process is psychological assessment. And when that occurs, then a family has a chance to gain some information about not only this child, but also what it is that they need, what it is that is creating and maintaining this behavior for them, and what they can do. So it can be a sense of empowerment for a family if they're given the amount of support that they need.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what can be really important is for a hospital staff to keep an understanding about what factors might get in the way of providing this information, and perhaps have a system in place to provide transportation to families that are struggling, or to be able to engage in case management and community support. Oftentimes, I know that Dr. Nichols mentioned earlier, NAMI mm-hmm. is a really great organization. They have family-to-family support groups mm-hmm. that are available, which can be a really great way to just understand that you're not alone in this.
And that's N-O-M-I?
N-A-M-I.
Thank you.
Yes.
N-A-M-I.
Yes. I think it's really important to just validate that the family is experiencing something that is stressful, and that it is important that they seek supports not only in caregiving for this individual, but that they also have the option to go into maybe individual therapy or group therapy or family therapy and really gain some extra support in managing their own care.
So it's not just that the person who is diagnosed with mental illness would feel a stigma or have a feeling of isolation or being alone, but also the siblings or the parent. And as you mentioned, there could be some disappointment, a feeling of loss, a feeling of sadness and depression because of what you had always hoped for and now might shift. Doesn't necessarily have to shift, but it might change. So then therapy for the siblings or for a parent, caregiver, et cetera, can allow them to feel that they're part of a community, that this is not isolating.
Absolutely.
All right.
I think that it's important, too, that that information be provided in a way that is easy to understand. A lot of times there are pamphlets that can be handed out to families that are written in developmentally appropriate language, And what that can do is really provide a family an opportunity to not only take in that information at the hospital or the community mental health center, but really be able to take that home and process it later.
Okay, so then when we have the pamphlets and things, and people like, and I will take this back to a medical issue. When my children have been sick, there have been times where I completely process what I've been told by the doctor, and by the time I get to the car, I go, okay, wait a second, I got to go back. NAMI would be a place where people could go and get some more information. They can Google it. But again, we were talking earlier that Googling information is not necessarily always the safest way to go.
Absolutely.
It gives us a lot of misinformation with nuggets of good stuff stuck in the middle. So you have to really dig through this. Basically, what we need to do is, again, as you mentioned at the beginning, that family needs to be the front line. If there are changes or things that you realize are different, to try to get some to seek a consult or move forward in treating as if it were a medical illness or something, because this is far more common than we probably would have thought. I never would have thought 20%. Never would have thought 20%. And then to only have 20% of that 20% actually properly diagnosed. Very enlightening that we need to make tremendous improvements on our psychological and psychiatric care of our youth. This is something that you should talk to your pediatrician about, or definitely acknowledge, maybe a counselor at the school, but definitely acknowledge if you feel something is changing or is different. Lauren, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And coming in and sharing your knowledge with us. This is going to conclude our show on Raising a Child with Mental Illness. Again, I'm Hannah Stanley, and this is on Social Health and Change, presented by Adler University. Please take a moment and hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our fantastic segments. Thank you for listening.